Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
To move at least 25,000 Hurricane Katrina refugees, mostly from the leaking Superdome in New Orleans, to the Astrodome in Houston, Texas. And Texas Governor Rick Perry says Texas schools will be open to evacuated Louisiana children. The enormity of the aftermath of Katrina is becoming more and more apparent. Officials say the death toll in inundated New Orleans may rise to the hundreds. And with as many as 8 offshore oil refineries out of service, the price of gas is already skyrocketing at the pumps. Well, we begin our coverage with Boston Globe reporter Brian McQuarrie, who covered the storm's devastation in Mississippi. He's now in Louisiana, where officials held a press conference this morning about Lake Pontchartrain, which punched through a levee and flooded New Orleans yesterday. Brian, what are officials saying today?
Well, they're saying that the lake has calmed down about 5 feet. It's still about 2 feet above normal now. They're saying that they believe that most of the 5 feet that it's come down has flown into the city itself. What they're saying, what they're going to try to do today is to put some concrete barriers in there, some sandbags, to stop the breach. Mm-hmm. And it appears that today they are going to try to evacuate as many of the people who are left inside the city as they can. It's a massive effort.
And explain, because you're there, what is the difficulty in getting out? Someone might say, well, you just head for the nearest road. They are sort of fenced in. Could you explain that?
Oh, they're stuck, right? I mean, the lake is on one side, the river is on another side, and about 4/5 of the streets in the town are underwater. I mean, mm-hmm. they just cannot get in their cars and move. I mean, they're stuck there now.
But the good news, the lake, as you said, down a bit, a few feet, and an evacuation effort going to start up again. Well, you know, you were in Gulfport, Mississippi yesterday, and you've written about that. You are describing an unimaginable scene. Tell us a little bit of what you saw.
I was in New York the night of 9/11. I was in Baghdad the day it fell. But what I saw in Gulfport yesterday was the greatest natural disaster I've seen. I got down to the beach, and it was just level. And there were dazed residents there just trying to sift through their homes.
Well, I'm looking at some of your writing in Biloxi. The only remaining evidence of a beach apartment complex is a concrete slab. You're seeing crushed red toy wagon, jewelry, clothing, twisted boards mixed in with debris. Talk about people swimming away from buildings and pushing cars away as they swim.
It just seemed to me that this was a scene of people just trying to sort of survive. I mean, just pushed to the point of desperation. I mean, you don't expect to find a car in your way when you're swimming away. Shrimp boats stacked like lumber on the riverbanks. Trees down. One of the things that I saw on my ride from Gulfport to here was there is practically no fuel available because there's no power. People who are trying to leave here are stuck on the side of the road, often with no food. Families taking shelters at rest areas in the open.
Because they have no gas.
Right. And what struck me from my time in Baghdad was that when you did find a gas station, and it took me about 200 miles to find one, cars were backed up about 5 miles on the interstate just to try to get some gasoline.
Brian McQuarrie is a reporter for the Boston Globe. He's been in both Biloxi, Mississippi, and now in Louisiana. Brian, thanks for speaking with us today.
Sure, thank you.
Well, Peter Wawiski is with the Washington Post. He was on a truck being evacuated from New Orleans when we lost our cell phone connection with him yesterday. Peter, you beat a hasty retreat. We just want to check back in with you. What did you see as you left New Orleans?
It was a pretty amazing sight because once we got out, we were lucky, I think, to get out when we did, because even though we were in elevated trucks, the water was almost at the level of the backs of the trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And we got up on the once we got up on the I-10 overpass, we could see had a kind of panoramic view of the city, and it was you could see smoke burning in a couple of different places on the horizon. Apparently, emergency workers couldn't get there because of the water that was blocking the way. You see all these people with their luggage packed into their cars, stalled in the water. You could see people actually walking along Interstate 10 with just small parcels, probably the only thing they might have left, just trying to find drier land somewhere else.
Well, now we understand you're in Baton Rouge, where evidence of the storm is the people like you, the refugees, so to speak, who are crowding into Baton Rouge.
Yeah, I haven't been there yet, but I'm told the convention center here is packed, and you can't find a hotel room. And I actually found a bunk at the what was formerly a Bible college. People are sleeping all over the place.
What's the sense? What's the mood of people? I mean, they knew the storm was coming. They knew it could be the worst, but still, I mean, what are you seeing in people's faces?
Just sort of despair, shock. A lot of people at the place that I was staying last night is actually a lot of energy electrical workers who have homes in New Orleans, and they're all joking that everybody had waterfront property now. So some people are in pretty good spirits, probably because they realize maybe they have at least their families intact, but. On the other hand, they know they have a hard road ahead.
Yeah. Waterfront properties, indeed. Peter Whiskey, reporter for The Washington Post. Peter, thank you, because, some listeners were wondering what happened to you. So thanks for getting back in touch.
Okay.
Peter Whiskey of The Washington Post. Well, drive by a gas station right now and you will see them changing gas prices. The Bush administration today announced plans to release fuel from the National Strategic Petroleum Reserve. That's the supply used to relieve shortages in times of national emergency. Many analysts say that emergency is here. Peter Butel is the president of the energy risk management firm Cameron Hanover. Peter, we spoke to you early this week when the hurricane hit. You said gas prices would go up to 20 cents a gallon by the end of the weekend. What's going on?
Well, right now we're up 65 cents in the northern tier and up as much as $1.10 throughout parts of the Midwest and some of the southern states. Basically, we will see increases right away of 65 cents to $1.10 across the nation.
A gallon.
A gallon, and that's based against Friday's prices.
Right, and this is all because of the hurricane?
Well, yeah, I mean, we had a very tight situation before, and I kind of jokingly made a reference to the Wall Street Journal, and I said, if I were to go to my local gas station and spill a bottle of motor oil, prices would go up. It's that tight. And then on top of that, to have 8 refineries go down, which represents roughly 10% of the nation's refining capacity, it's just untenable, and we're losing supplies on a daily basis, and this is just absolutely the worst case scenario. Many of us had said the one thing we do not need this summer is a repeat of Ivan last year. Well, Katrina was worse.
Well, and it could have been worse because it wasn't even a direct hit, as we know. What do you make of the president's decision to open the reserves?
Well, it's an attempt to try to cool some of the speculative ardor that we have in this market, and for that reason I applaud it. It is a sad commentary, though, that this is the best we can do. We need to have gasoline strategic reserves. We need to have heating oil and diesel strategic reserves. We have a heating oil strategic reserve in the Northeast, but it's about a thimble full of oil. We need to really address this problem for the future in a much more aggressive manner.
Of course, in the South, we're hearing about people just stranded without gas, 5-mile backup to get gas in Mississippi. That's, of course, in that area. What do you expect to see rippling out across the country?
Well, I think parts of the Midwest are already starting to see some gas lines forming. We haven't seen it yet in the Northeast. We have not yet seen it in California. So my advice to everybody, and I'm doing this myself, is if you can carpool at all, if you don't have to drive somewhere, don't, because it's very possible that we will see gasoline lines, potentially long lines, even rationing throughout many regions of this country before this whole thing settles out. We have no idea how long it's going to take to get these refineries back up. Some of them are flooded. And they can't really take the flooding out until we get some power back. So we've got some, you know, a lot of questions, very few answers. All of the electrical workers, the skilled electrical workers from around the country, are converging on the area, trying to help as best they can. We're doing everything we can, but at this point, it looks like, you know, we may go through a period where we really do need to conserve above and beyond the economic cost, and the economic cost is staggering. The American consumer right now is paying more than $1 billion a day, more than he and she were 3 years ago for energy. That includes the whole ball of wax. Interesting thing, January 2002, the average wholesale price for gasoline before taxes and retail profit was 57.5 cents. And in the last couple of days, we have risen more than the entire price of January 2002. We've risen 65 to $1.10.
In a couple of days. Some analysts saying this could be the tipping point. You're you know, alluding to that, but towards a recession.
I'm absolutely convinced. I saw a chart a couple of years ago at a seminar, and it was a chart of U.S. economic activity. I looked at it and said, wait, why does that look so familiar? Turned it upside down. It was an inverse chart of oil activity with a lag of about 15 to 18 months. You know, every major recession this country's had in 30 years has been preceded by a tripling of oil prices. Well, now we have natural gas compared to just January 2002 up 5.5 times. We've got crude oil up 3.5 times. We've got gasoline now up 5 times as much. So, you know, we're talking about potentially, in my opinion, one of the worst recessions that any of us may have the misfortune to live through. So I'm very upset about this, and you know, we need to do so many things. We need to have victory solar panels, victory windmills in our backyards. We need to start paying attention to some of the bright minds, and I've been lucky because some people have been calling me saying we've got the answers. We've worked on these new technologies that can do some incredible things. Well, we need to have the oil companies and the car companies and the government start paying attention to some of our great minds. I'm a firm believer that the greatest resource that the United States has is the intelligence and the capability of American minds and our resourcefulness, our inventiveness, and that may be the only way we're going to get out of this mess.
Peter Butel is the president of the energy risk management firm Cameron Hanover, telling us about gas prices increasing 65 cents to a dollar already a gallon across the country in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and of course telling us so much more. Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And just ahead, a more personal reflection on Katrina's aftermath and man's role in this catastrophe with John Barry, New Orleans resident and author of the book Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927 and How It Changed America. Much more coming up here and now. Disaster unfolding in the Gulf as a faraway event, but of course for others, it's close to home. It is home. John Barry lives in New Orleans most of the year. He's author of the book Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927 and How It Changed America, and he joins us from his offices in Washington, D.C., where he's been following all of this. John, welcome and welcome back.
Well, thank you. I'd just as soon not be here.
I understand. Yeah, I understand. We've spoken to you before about the flu pandemic, your book, The Great Influenza. What is it like for you to watch this, having researched other catastrophes?
Well, living through it, of course, is very different. I almost feel guilty because as of at least 2 hours ago, my home was one of the few in the city that was dry, although there may be water in it now.
You lived in the French Quarter of New Orleans?
Correct.
Yeah. And how do you know? What are people telling you?
Well, I have a neighbor who Saturday hung up the phone on me when I tried to convince him to leave. But, you know, I've been in touch with him fairly regularly, more to give him news of what's going on because, of course, he's, you know, no power. you can't. He's totally isolated. But he has told me the water is two blocks away, but, you know, hasn't advanced recently.
Right. And what else has happened to this fabled French Quarter? You know, and for those who haven't been there or for some reason haven't seen it, I mean, just describe it for us as well.
Well, it's one of the architectural gems of North America. Many people who go to New Orleans consider it a European city, or more so than any other part of the United States, at any rate. In fact, I spend a lot of time in Washington and New Orleans, and I consider Washington sort of the most uptight city in America, and New Orleans the most laid-back city.
Yeah.
You know, it's named the Big Easy and so forth. You know, I don't know that the city will ever recover from this fully, frankly.
Well,
I have written about several disasters, and incidentally, I tell people I will never again the rest of my life, and I said this before this event, that I would never write about a disaster again. I've written about disasters chiefly because I think when you look at a society under intense pressure in a crisis situation, it reveals its true nature. But you know, I know we had the San Francisco earthquake, the 1927 flood. Most of your listeners probably aren't familiar with, but that put almost 1% of the entire population of the country was flooded. It killed people from Virginia to Oklahoma, although most of the devastation was along the lower Mississippi River. And that had dramatic impact on American politics, on demographics, moving a lot of African Americans out of the South, elected Hoover president. But on the region that was devastated, which was mostly the agricultural areas along the lower Mississippi, essentially it really didn't change that much. This is different. You know, New Orleans basically has two things going for it economically. One is the port, and the other is tourism. And the tourism isn't just people visiting for a weekend. It's, you know, people booking conventions where 25,000 people show up. And I don't know that those things will be booked in the future. And that will be as destructive as the hurricane.
Well, in fact, well, in fact, there are others who are agreeing with you that, you know, houses that have been wet to the roof might have to come down, and that there's no way to rebuild the character that was there.
Well, that's the, you know, I mean, every part of that city has a different kind of architecture, and in every part of it is really, I mean, I love the whole feel of all of it. You know, much of that is true, certainly.
And I just want to ask you, we're going to talk at length in just a couple minutes about the role of man in this disaster, the marshes, the building of shipping canals, the coastal erosion. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that may have been a major factor in the initial flooding in St. Bernard Parish in New Orleans East, which is the first levee break was on what's called the Industrial Canal, and that runs from the lake to the river and connects to some other waterways. And that's a man-made, as the name suggests, a canal that was built in 1922. And all the coastal, I mean, Louisiana loses a football field of land every 15 minutes, melts into the ocean. An island the size of Manhattan every 10 months melts into the ocean. And so even over a period of 10 or 15 years, much less 50 or 60 years, there's been dramatic erosion of the coastline, and all of that land would normally act like a sponge and soak up storm surge from a hurricane.
And so we're going to talk more about that, but you were quoted as saying today in the LA Times that the refusal to build spillways and reservoirs exacerbated the effects of the 1927 flood. Now you and others might be thinking that some of man's inaction contributed to Katrina's destruction. We'll have more on that. But in the minute we have left, how hard is it to watch your city from afar?
Well, it's, you know, you feel utterly helpless. And there's a novel called The Last of the Just, which is, you know, during the Holocaust. And the main character is Jewish, and he the book ends is he's pounding on the door of one of the camps wanting to be admitted to share the fate of everybody else. And, I mean, there's a little bit of that. I feel that is probably more than I feel relief at the fact that at least so far my home is in decent shape.
John Barry is the author of the book Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927 and How It Changed America. He lives in the French Quarter, New Orleans. As he said, he's heard his house is okay, but it's one of the few that is dry in that area. He's speaking to us from the other city he visits, Washington, D.C., where he has to watch from the sidelines. John, thanks, and I hope we can call you again.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Would have wreaked even more havoc on the city of New Orleans if not for the marshes and barrier islands that protect that city. But they are disappearing. And joining us with more on man's role in the devastation in the South is author Christopher Hollowell. His book, Holding Back the Sea, focuses on the disappearing Louisiana coastline. And Christopher, first, I just want to ask, I know this is your area of expertise, but I'm wondering if even you were shocked to see the devastation. You know, what's been your response?
I was shocked. Everyone was shocked, certainly. But this is something that people in New Orleans and all of South Louisiana have feared for a long time. And it was particularly ravaging because of the loss of the marshes which surround New Orleans and line the coast.
Well, let's stop for a second, because I was shocked myself to see that 40% of the wetlands in the U.S. mainland are in Louisiana.
That's right, 40% of the coastal wetlands.
And that's a lot, and that they are, you know, disappearing over the last century. Why are they disappearing?
Well, most of it has to do with the extensive levying of the Mississippi River, which the Europeans, or the French and the Spanish, began at the beginning of the 18th century.
And remind us, well, you know, we all had sixth grade history, but remind us how a levee works.
A levee is a dike, and dikes that line the banks of the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And from St. Louis, Missouri, all the way down to below New Orleans, the Mississippi River has these levees on either bank to prevent flooding.
And how does that affect the marshes?
Well, marshes have to be sustained through nutrients and silt. And traditionally, before the levees were built, every spring the Mississippi River would flood and pour tons and tons of sediment into the marshes. Mm. Since 1927, after the Great Flood, the levees were heightened and strengthened, and now virtually no water can get into the marshes. As a result, they've compacted terribly. The soft land has just sunk. And exacerbating the situation, the oil and gas industry over the years have dredged canals in all directions through the marshes in order to lay pipelines and to put in drilling equipment. So a lot of salt water has been able to enter the marsh, surge into the marsh during winter storms, and because the land is so soft, there's been tremendous erosion. Mm. So if you take a plane over the marshes, you just see the marshes, this one once green blanket of marshes, just torn up by canals, by little islands all over the place, cabins out in the middle of the water. And when the Europeans came here, there were about 5 million acres of coastal wetlands in Louisiana. Now there are a little over 3 million, and the loss right now is about 16,000 acres every year.
And there's some irony there, because here everyone's bemoaning the loss of oil, you know, and the rigs and the infrastructure because of the hurricane, but in fact the hurricane might have hit harder because of the loss of marshes, in part created by the oil refineries.
Well, that's very, very true. The United States Geological Survey has it that about 30% 6% of the loss is due to the dredging of canals by the oil and gas industry.
Well, but you also mentioned the levees, and I'm wondering, you know, without those levees, you know, life as we know it along the river wouldn't exist. So,
It's one of these awkward trade-offs. Without the levees, the Mississippi River would probably be unnavigable.
Well, is there a way to restore the marshes and while keeping the levees?
Well, this has been the subject of enormous concern, anguish, argument in Louisiana for, well, practically since the 1950s when the problem was really looked at seriously. There are ways of restoring the marsh, maybe stabilizing the marsh is a better word than restoring it.
Mm-hmm.
And one way is to build up the barrier islands.
These are the string of islands, you know, off in the water that are uninhabited and sort of act as a buffer.
That's right, exactly right, yeah.
Yeah.
And you cannot find the Army Corps of Engineers blameless also, because they have done their share of dredging canals through the marsh for navigational purposes. One of these canals goes directly from the Gulf of Mexico to New Orleans, through the marsh, and it's called the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet. It's a very notorious passage of water in Louisiana because it has eroded the marsh terribly. Gulf water has surged up this channel time and again, and it is ironically where this canal comes into New Orleans is exactly where the levee broke, which has flooded the southern part of the city now.
Well, now tell us more about that. Do you think the levee broke because of the pressure of that water, or was the levee weakened?
Well, that you know what actually happened will be determined, but the fact is that it's just a straight shot from the Gulf to New Orleans. The water surging up there could very easily have put so much pressure against that levee, which also broke during Hurricane Betsy in 1965 and flooded the same area of New Orleans as is underwater right now.
Well, in fact, we've been reading reports from, you know, the last year prior to Hurricane Katrina of officials in New Orleans bemoaning the fact that some of the money to strengthen and fix the levees was detoured to other homeland security issues. And they were saying, warning, that that could be a problem.
Well, if the government has doled out $60 or $70 million per year, which sounds like a lot, to help remedy the problem. But this problem is so big that the calculations are that it would cost $14 billion to stabilize the marsh. And the federal government has turned a blind eye to this. And there has been a real national lack of realization that this part of the country, New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, is a vital, vital resource. The port of New Orleans is the biggest port in the country. Practically all of our grain from the Midwest, from the Grain Belt, goes down the Mississippi River. 40% of the nation's fish catch comes out of the Gulf of Mexico. Most of those fish are nurtured in the wetlands. 25% of our oil and gas comes across that coastline.
Well, I was just going to ask because, you know, some might say $14 billion, you know, and it keeps getting whacked. Maybe there's a, sort of an evolution thing happening here. Maybe we just don't live in New Orleans anymore. Your response to that?
It's going to be months, probably years, before the city gets back on its feet because much of the city is under 20 feet of water. And to get that water out is going to be an enormous job. There have been no plans mentioned how to get that water out.
Christopher Hollowell, author of Holding Back the Sea. It's about coastline erosion along the Louisiana coastline. He's also a professor of journalism at Baruch College in New York City, pointing out the next problem, getting the water that came in out. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, radio stations in the Gulf are keeping listeners informed with developments and trying to help people find missing loved ones in the aftermath of Katrina. We thought we'd eavesdrop. Here's an excerpt from News Radio 1150 WJBO in Baton Rouge.
Rhonda, thank you for calling. How may we assist? You are on the air, Rhonda.
Well, actually, I'm in search of a very elderly couple that was shipped out on a bus from Plaquemines Parish. It's a little town called Wills Point and Braithwaite. They are 90 and 86. I don't know where the bus took them.
When did they leave?
They left Saturday at 3 o'clock. I've been attempting to call Plaquemines Parish OEP, but you just can't get through.
No, you can't get through.
If anybody down there in Plaquemines Parish knows where that bus went with those evacuees, I'll leave you my numbers. They are extremely fragile.
Yeah, this is Omar Landwood, State Police.
Yes.
I would tell you, if you had that bus, you said a bus left possibly Saturday, they would have either taken those individuals, well, not necessarily to the Superdome. I don't think that would be the case, especially if they were elderly and they came from St. Bernard Parish. More than likely, they may be somewhere in the Baton Rouge area. It may be possible.
Let's hope. And here are some of the thoughts of callers to Jim Engster. He's host of the morning radio show on the NPR station in Baton Rouge, WRKF.
State offices in 20 parishes remain closed through today in regions of the state most affected by the passage of Hurricane Katrina. They include Ascension, Assumption, East Baton Rouge, East Feliciana, Jefferson, Lafourche, Livingston, Orleans, Plaquemines, St. Bernard, St. Charles, St. Helena, St. James, St. John, St. Tammany, St. Mary, Tangipahoa, Terrebonne, and Washington parishes. We're joined at this time by Sergeant Kathy Flincham of State Police. And Sergeant Flincham, there certainly are many cases in which people have not had contact with loved ones. Cell phone use is almost impossible in certain areas. I would imagine there is great concern for many about people who are near and dear to them and how they fared through this storm.
Absolutely, and I sympathize with them firsthand. I have some folks down there that I have not heard from either, so I truly can tell them that I understand exactly what they're going through. We ask the folks, send us your prayers. We are not going to quit. It's a 24-hour operation, and we may be knocked down, but we're going to get up.
Jane at LSU has been waiting patiently. Jane, good morning.
Good morning. I guess my question, I'm a student at LSU, and I've just been watching the devastation on television and hearing reports, and it's been a very emotional process for lots of people here, and I think a lot of us, maybe a lot of students still in town, still feel very isolated and very helpless to know how we can help and what we can do. And I heard mentioned earlier about the Red Cross contacting them on how to volunteer, but I'm trying to figure out a way that students, we can organize students to rally around this effort. And I'd like to hear some, possibly
right,
some suggestions.
Well, you could start with the Red Cross. 291-4533 is the local number. 291-4533, and in fact, their shelter is not far from where you are, Jane, and there are a lot of people who need help, and warm, able bodies are a necessity right now, and we thank you for your concern and your diligence, and get out there and do what you can.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane.
Some of the callers to radio stations in the Baton Rouge area. That was the Jim Engster Show on NPR station WRKF. We also heard a snippet from News Radio 1130 WJBO. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. coordinating what officials are describing as the biggest relief operation in its history. Joining us is Carol Yelverton. She's spokesperson for the American Red Cross. Carol, what is your agency doing in the region?
Right now, we have many volunteers and many emergency response vehicles. And what we're doing right now is fanning out across these areas as we can. And truly, we have our emergency response vehicles packed with food. And as our people are coming across groups, we're finding groups of people at fire stations or community centers who are kind of huddled together. We are feeding people as we find them. So we are moving through these areas, offering help as we encounter people.
What can people do?
We need funds to buy a lot of food. We're going to be feeding people for a long time to come, as well as providing basic necessities and shelter. It's not going to be temporary shelter at this point. We know that we're going to have some long-term issues on our hands that we're going to be working with our federal partners on.
Okay, so money is the thing that you need right now.
Exactly, and it's redcross.org or 1-800-HELP-NOW.
That's all we needed to know. Carol, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Carol Yelverton, a spokesperson for the American Red Cross.
I've been writing songs since I'm very young, and I do it because if there wasn't that, I wouldn't be here.
Je pourrais bien brûler les preuves, trier les pages de mon passé, prendre un bassin ou même un fleuve pour abonder le peu que j'ai.
That's Keren Ann, K-E-R-E-N, a global chanteuse who sings in both French and English, was born to a Javanese-Dutch mother and Russian-Israeli father, and is building a worldwide cult following. She says her life is like that of a sailor, always traveling, but on her rare time off the road, she rests her head in Paris and New York and soaks in the moods of those cities. Her latest CD, Nolita, takes its name from a neighborhood in Manhattan. Earlier this summer, Keren Ann spoke to Here Now producer April Peavy before a performance at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston.
I'd categorize it as very laid-back, lazy rock. I don't know, I've seen so many expressions to describe music. I just, the way it's done, the very laid-back mood I'm in when I need to have silence and calmness, but I also need to know that there is noise across the street so I can go and get it if I need it when I make songs.
23rd was empty. I heard somebody yell. Straight-laced passerbys all over the hotel. And Chelsea Burns. Chelsea Burns.
It's nice to be in a place that is crowded, full of noise, and feel uncomfortable about that. So trying to recreate your own space, your own isolated space, with which is very calm and silent. Mm-hmm. This way you can take it as a refuge or escape from the crowd, but then you know that the crowd is not very far. I think it's a way of living of sailors. They have to be in the sea all the time, away from everything, but they also have to get to harbors and see and touch the ground. And I really like, this is basically what I like about the traveling.
And what you just said, too, describes a little bit about how the CD was recorded. Half of the CD was recorded in New York, but in the very early morning hours at dawn.
Yeah, because, you know, these are the hours that you have the city for yourself. And New York is one of those cities, just like Paris, that you maintain a relationship, a kind of a partnership relationship. When you come back to New York and you go over the Brooklyn Bridge, it's like coming back to the one you love. And it's the same when you go to Paris. And I guess that if I'm one of many mistresses of New York, then the only time I had it for myself was early mornings.
It's late. I think I'm gonna stay. I think I'm gonna bury you.
Describe, if you will, the neighborhood of New York, Nolita.
It's a few streets that are between West and East Village. They're just above Little Italy in Chinatown. Already just in the name, north of Little Italy, it's the north of somewhere. There's something very feminine about it. There is also something in the neighborhood that is very, you know how in New York sometimes you can touch the history with your hands. I know that in Paris the history is so authentic and so old that everywhere you go you just feel that it was there, but now it's far ahead. You feel in the future. But in New York you just breathe yesterday. You know, it's like you can see things and they're a part of a book that you read 30 years ago, but it's still there. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of it. And, you know, Lisa, you feel it very much. So I think that's also why I'm so much attached to the city.
Ideas for the characters in your songs, are they from characters that you just sort of dream up in New York?
Basically, Nolita was a big challenge for me. It was burying a lot of things from the past, whether my own things or my narrator's things. When I say my narrator's, it's because I get attached to characters that can be fiction, but if I get attached to them, it's because their lives are similar to mine. They're just not 100% similar to mine. So all the narrators in the Nolita album are girls that could have been lost or stalked or in love or disappointed. But it's not necessarily love songs, it's just their stories and some state of minds they could have been in, some feelings of need of revenge. But it's done in a way that Alice in Wonderland would have done it. People sometimes say that it's hard to understand because it's not in the very realistic approach. But I don't see life in a realistic approach because everything is subjective and there is always a way to see things with illusion and magic. And even if things are very much down to earth and they're very simple, sometimes they can become very dramatic and very, if you want to change them into romance, but if you want to change them into light and just happy for the day, you just have to change them into illusion and magic. And I guess my mom was from Java, and she had this way of seeing things. And I stole it from her a little bit.
Do you feel sad when a song that you've written is over, that you're saying goodbye to that character?
I guess that naturally, when you finish something, you feel that you lost something. You have one thing less, but you also have one thing more. It's just another physical form, because before being a song, it's in your mind, and it obsesses you in some way. And once it's a song, you have place for other stuff to come into your mind.
Midi dans le salon de la duchesse. Il me dit que tu fais de ta jeunesse. Elle est ta seule.
That's singer-songwriter Karen Ann. A nice break from our hurricane coverage today. Karen Ann spoke to Here and Now producer April Peavy. April is spreading her wings today. And April, we hope they bring you back here real soon. They better. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com, and by REMAX of New England, a source for real estate assistance in New England, featuring an online renovation guide, agent locator, and comprehensive property search. REMAX-NewEngland.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here.